Tuesday, May the 4th, back from my 3 days in Texas. My desk was in its hopeless state, the kind that takes digging, and so are my appointments. Lyndon looked tired and worn. The Dominican troubles had taken their toll. Paul Glenn told me that he had had a bad cold, and Dr. Gould had been down doctoring his throat. Also, he gained back 3 of the 12 pounds he had so proudly lost. When he'd gotten up to 226, that's when it really struck home to him, because that was a little bit more than he had been 10 years ago. So in a little over a week's time, he brought it down 12 pounds. Once in gear, his willpower carries him along like a tank. No drinks, but then he's hardly had any drinks for months and months. His undoing is 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock dinners, at which he has had little lunch or no lunch, and tea and melon for breakfast, and so he's ravenous and eats hugely, especially desserts. He was very quiet and calm, in spite of being so weary. Linda's article has come out in Life. It really looks and reads better than we had thought. And Lucy, bless her, is just bubbling with praise of her sister. Linda is choosing the charities with a great deal of pleasure that she's going to give the money to. Bless her. One of them is my beautification project. Because of being out of town for several days, and just because it's the merry month of May, my publicity pictures for Good Works had mounted up until there were 5. Then, because I hadn't been able to go to the State Department concert last night as I'd planned, a group of Metropolitan Opera singers, headed by Reese Stevens, had come for a tour of the White House, and I had wanted to meet them. So first on the day, was down to the state dining room, where they were all lined up. And how young and pretty opera singers have become. These were all Americans. Lisa Stevens doesn't sing. She's the co-manager. She's taking them to 70 American cities, Austin among them. They were so full of youth and enthusiasm. I was delighted to see them. Opera indeed has a new face. Next, I went to the Red Room to meet 2 chief workers of Project Hope and to receive tickets to the Hope Ball, which makes money for the fabulous ship that docks in an African port or a South American port, equipped with hospital facilities, excellent doctors and nurses, and handles all comers. Young doctors donate months of their time free. It's sort of like being a missionary. I'm sure when the history of this period is written, the volunteer spirit, particularly in this country, will stand out as a magnificent phenomenon. Volunteers, foundations, automation, space, and the war on poverty. What a decade, what a generation I live in. It was an assembly line. Next, I went to the Blue Room to hear Mrs. Luther Terry and John Walker of the National Gallery explain about pictures for patients, reproductions to be made available for hospital patients to hang on the walls of their room. They would be rolled around on a cart, sort of like a bookmobile, so that the patient could make a choice. Hang it for a while and then maybe change it, or the next patient could. Imaginative, delightful idea. And then to the Green Room to meet the Multiple Sclerosis Mother of the Year, Mrs. Allen Somm, her husband and child. She, Mrs. Somm, in a wheelchair, able to talk only quite pitifully, giving you that uneasy feeling of, my God, I do so little to deserve what I've got. And of all people in the group, oddly enough, Sally Jane Height. And then downstairs to the library for quite a change of scene. 2 very happy, very elderly people, a lady and a gentleman, seated on the sofa, beaming, just delighted to tell me all about the Episcopal Home for the Aged. She, Mrs. Edmonia Whitehead, had worked herself for some 40 years with a project very much like Head Start and had plenty of information and advice to give me on it. They both seemed so happy. They wanted me to come to the style show, which raises funds for the Episcopal Home. And then out to the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden, where the Bethesda Chamber of Commerce, rather about 6 men representing it, showed me a big color photograph of their 66,000 beautification project, which will extend down the heart of the business section of Wisconsin Avenue. Street trees, flowers in large cement tubs, a charming drawing, a cross-section of men, architects, businessmen, Chamber of Commerce men, who'd been working on it for several years. I was glad to do all of this, but it was an assembly line and seemed ungracious to them, and I told Liz to let us not permit it to happen anymore, 5 or 6 in a row. Then I was off to a big event of each spring, the Senate Ladies' Luncheon. And so it has been for me since 1949, the high point of the year. As we went out there, White House grounds, I thought with a pang of embarrassment that we'd closed off the tourist hours because of all our activities. Lennon's briefing the members of the House and Senate in the East Room, and joint congressional leadership meeting, then a presentation to Admiral Smith for the Distinguished Service Medal in the Rose Garden. Oh, this old house has been rocking this morning. The Senate ladies are back once more in the Senate caucus room in the old Senate office building, one of the handsomest rooms in this town. Classic, elegant, enormous. Mrs. Brewster of Maryland was the Democratic chairman, with Betty Kuchel as a co-chairman. Betty's getting to be practically professional. This is about the third time in my memory she's done it. As always, the decorations were important. This time, a paisley green tablecloth made by the Senate wives themselves. Green and white centerpieces, and the most elaborate and delicious lunch. The first course, avocado with crab meat Maryland, would have been enough itself. Mrs. Brewster's constituents, I'm sure, provided that, as did Betty's, the California Royal Squab, and Muriel's, the Minnesota Wild Rice. Practically all of the cabinet was there, and among the old-timers present, and how that word changes with the years, for Mrs. Irving Ives of New York, and Mrs. Prescott Bush of Connecticut. The two Mrs. Kennedys, Mrs. Bobby and Mrs. Ted, sat together and chatted with each other most of the time, two of the prettiest women in the room. It's a thoroughly relaxing occasion, because nobody has to make a speech. Muriel presided, and I thanked them for the green leather photograph album inscribed to Lady Bird Johnson with affection from the Senate wives. And of course, one of the high moments was to hear Mrs. Toby's report on bandage making. I'm almost sorry that they were ahead of the record made when I was in charge. I almost asked, where's my maple sugar candy? But sure enough, there at the door was Mrs. Flanders from Vermont with the maple leaf shape of candy we've received every year. A pleasant, easy occasion full of vital statistics about so-and-so's children or grandchildren and news of the Hill. Back at the White House, I met with Mr. James Babb, who's carried the load for the White House Library, and with the other committee members, friends, and donors of the library, to thank them for bringing it to its present state of completion, except that it isn't really, because as long as life goes on and people write, there'll be more to choose from and add to it. And then, presently, we were joined by a cross-section of the world of books, authors, publishers, critics, for the ceremony to award the first National Medal for Literature to Thornton Wilder for the whole body of his work. It turned out to be, for me, one of the most thoroughly congenial and, in a way, lustrous gatherings that I've ever had in the White House. I was delighted to be with Thornton Wilder, and I thought he was a happy choice. He left me aglow with his remarks, and I must say for once I was pleased with myself. I felt at home with these people and with what I said. Donald McGannon of Westinghouse Broadcasting, who's responsible for the movie on the paintings of the White House, was there. My old friends, the Elliott Janeways, Robert Gutwillig of McGraw-Hill, who's working with us on Mrs. Johnson's album, Cass Canfield of Harper & Row, Oliver Jensen of American Heritage, who's working on the booklet for Lyndon's Boyhood Home, James Fosbergs from the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, Mrs. Kennedy's mother and stepfather, the Hugh Auchincloss's, and the William Beinecke's, great contributors to the White House Library, and friends of the Ed Clarks. This was one of the cultural events of which Eric Goldman and Roger Stevens are the midwives, and I very happily go along with. I meant it when I said, of all the talents I wished I possessed, the one I most envied is the ability to make words march and sing and cannonade and talk the cool, demanding voice of reason. Well, it was a good afternoon. A nice thank you to the library committee, combining it with the laurel for the brow of Thornton Wilder, to make a very pleasant time. One of my problems of the day was a call from Van Cliburn to Lucy, asking her to appear with him in the Hollywood Bowl, July the 6th, to do Peter and the Wolf. My instinct, my mere stomach reaction, was no, although I'd loved her doing it at Interlochen. But I have to tread carefully with Lucy, my dear little free soul, so I sought the advice of people she likes and respects, who know the show world and are California, Dr. Frank Stanton, the Lloyd Hands, and Margie McNamara. It was after 11 when Lyndon came home to dinner. He'd called over A.W. Morrison in town for some REA business, and very weary and haggard, we had dinner. He talked about the Dominican Republic affair and got to bed, but not to sleep, well after midnight.